So I feel like I need to just give a little health update after I came in hot a couple weeks ago going, I was in debilitating stomach pain.
You need to tell everyone what almost took you out.
It's ridiculous. So this is more of a PSA than a cold open. But for those who don't know me, I've been diabetic my whole life, which lends to heart problems. It eventually leads to kidney problems. And those stomach pains were compounded with back pain around my kidneys. My blood pressure was in like the 80s and over 50s. I was starting to get woozy and passing out. Like, I thought I was cooked.
I started auditions for a new co-host, but I didn't tell you.
Well, that's the reason I hung on, because I didn't want to burden you with the show alone.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, all of this, eventually I trusted my body, which that's PSA number one. If your gut is telling you something, just believe it. It led to a 3-day stay in the hospital where they pumped me so full of fluids, my kidney functions were down to like 20%. And I was really, really scared. I've spent the past couple of weeks like just stressed and anxious, and that compounded everything. So they pumped me straight fluids for 3 days. And the great news is my kidneys are like jump-started. I think they were just shriveled up because I wasn't eating much. I wasn't drinking much. So I don't know, but I am back. I feel rejuvenated. No more stomach pain. I feel like a new man.
I told you your kidneys were like SpongeBob in the episode in the Sandy's Dome. Water!
Water would be nice.
So everybody, send Ed a message every 2 hours. Drink water, bitch.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that is the PSA. Water, water, water. They suggest I drink 2.6 liters of water a day, and that's considered hydrated. Like, I tried yesterday and I almost drowned.
I don't think I've had that much water in my entire life.
You are never again going to see Ed without I made fun of those giant water bottles that men never carry.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a 55-gallon drum attached to my hip.
Moving forward. It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What's shaking, crime crew? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, episode, what are we in, 63, I believe.
Yeah.
Of the most immersive true crime podcast in the history of the internet, the history of the world. I am your host, Ed Hydock, a 23-year veteran true crime producer, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
I am not making these wild claims, people. That's all him.
That's me. We're just going to shoot for the moon. Well, it is August, which means
new block, new theme.
Yep. Whoop, whoop. Do you ever feel wiped out after a block? Like, I'm beat. And I think it's the fact that we get so wrapped up in these cases, and because they all fit a theme, they're all kind of the same for a little bit. So I feel just a little mentally drained.
No, I get that. I definitely had that after January doing Ted Bundy and
the serial killers.
Gacy. I had to remove myself for a little bit. That was a lot.
Yes. Well, we are back and ready to start fresh this week with a block we're calling Small Town Secrets. And by that, we mean cases that happen in these tiny, close-knit communities where it seems like everybody knows who did it, but it would take years for investigators to either build a case and find the evidence and just get justice for these victims and their families. And maybe that's because the perp was threatening people if they talk. Maybe folks just like to keep to themselves. There's infinite number of reasons, but it happens in these small towns all the time.
Well, and we already kind of covered at least one case like this back in November, I think. We covered the murders of two best friends by those white trash hillbilly brothers.
Oh, Mayo, Michigan. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they tormented the entire town. And like everybody knew they were guilty, but people, A, were afraid. And, it took forever to prove it.
Yeah, and that really wasn't much of a secret. But those dudes were actually terrifying. So I completely understand why no one would snitch on them.
Oh, yeah.
Well, for August, we have some super cool things in store. And later this month, our featured case is going to be about a local Pennsylvania boy, local to us, named David Wellington Reed, whose case I covered twice in my career for two different shows. And that happens sometimes. You kind of dig into the well. You have a couple cases that you're on a new series and it's like, oh, I did this case a couple years ago and that fits the criteria. So we could maybe do it again and with a little different spin. But I became really personally attached to this story, again, because of the people involved. And I related to this boy. And we'll get into that later in the month. But not only do we have some super cool on-location stuff where we go to David's hometown and do some filming, but that kind of supplements the main case. But we'll also be ending the blog with an interview with Corporal Robert Betnar. And he's a retired state trooper slash cold case detective slash lawyer now. And he helped solve the case. And we've become great friends over the years, and he's really excited to be on the show, and Melissa and I are really excited to bring you his perspective.
Rob is great. We love him. We went to a grand jury hearing?
Coroner's inquest we went to.
Oh, right.
And, for a different case, not David's.
No, that Rob had worked on, so we love him. But
yes,
you will get to share in our adventures of going to the town where David lived. Mm-hmm. On the hottest day of the year.
I think it was.
But anyway, do you have anything else or can I kick off August with my case?
Just the usual standard reminders. Like if you like what you're hearing from us, please like, rate, subscribe, especially on our audio only platforms. I know a lot of people are watching here on YouTube, but we are not, I don't want to use the word desperate. I mean, it's whatever, but we could use some boosts on like our, we're not getting any reviews on the audio side. So are we reaching people? I have no idea. Like it's so hard to tell because there's limited engagement still, but I mean, that would help us immensely. Just help build our brand, build our product. And if you like us, show us.
And other reminder, take a drink of water right now. Stay hydrated.
Yeah. Yep. Seriously. I got to get through. So three of these is what comes out to about 2.6 liters. I swear to God, yesterday I was like, there was no room for food.
All right. Well, moving on. I'm glad you're drinking. But
yes.
Well, first of all, even though we're done covering badass women, because that was last month, this case has quite a few badass women who were really, really important to solving this case. And I'm going to be telling you about the murder of Mandy Stavik. And this murder took place in 1989, but it took 30 years to get justice, which didn't come until 2019.
Crazy.
This is truly a tale of people, like, maybe not knowing 100% who the killer was, but definitely having that gut feeling of, oh my God, I know who did it. And as I've complained about before, you can't get a conviction off a gut feeling. They frown upon that.
They kind of do. Could you imagine, like, the innocent people that would be in jail if gut feelings counted? Like, I can see the trial now. The judge would be like, Mr. Prosecutor, what evidence do you have against this man? We totally know he did it, Your Honor. Like, everybody knows.
Okay, it should count in some cases, i.e., OJ, Casey Anthony, come on.
Yeah.
Gut feeling should count there.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, sometimes I kind of start a case in the middle, but I think for Mandy, we should start at the beginning. So Amanda Teresa Stavik, who went by Mandy, was born on April 16th, 1971 in Bellingham, Alaska, to parents Glenn and Mary Stavik. And Mandy had four siblings, Brent, Molly, Mary Alice, and Lee. And Mandy was the youngest of the three girls, and then Lee was the baby. So Brent and Mary Alice were significantly older than Mandy. In 1974, Glenn and Mary divorced, and Mary took the three younger kids, Molly, Mandy, and Lee, and they moved to Acme, Washington, which is in Whatcom County. And actually, fun fact, Whatcom County is the most northwestern county in the state of Washington. Hmm. And just for reference, it's a little less than like 2 hours north of Seattle.
Okay.
And this is like the epitome of a small town where everyone knows each other and no one locked their doors. Hmm. According to a 2020 census, the town of Acme had 229 residents.
Wow.
So I can only imagine it was less in 1989. Yeah.
Yeah. So having been out in that region, I can totally like attest to this vibe. I mean, the houses are so spread apart. It's super rural. Like downtowns are small. They're very quaint. Only a couple shops and residents are, their circles are very small. And all of these people are like bonded by this environment. It's creepy, but it's awesome. I could totally see myself living out there.
Yeah, in a 2020 episode I watched, they were doing like sky views of where all the houses were on the street that Mandy lived, and they were very far apart.
Yeah. So I feel like you know your neighbors, but at the same time, you're not butted up next to each other. You have no real reason to interact, you know?
I'm butted up next to my neighbor and I don't know any of their names. So
see, you'd fit right in.
You don't have to talk to them. So while Mary and the kids had a fresh start in Acme, Mandy's father, Glenn, stayed in Alaska, and he did end up remarrying. So Mandy went on to have a few step-siblings. But, all right, we've talked about this before. Like, you know how we seem to always come across those families who just experience hit after hit? Like, just so much loss and grief. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how does this happen to one family?
Yeah, see it all the time.
Well, the Stavik family sadly falls in that category. In 1975, Mandy's older brother, Brent, who was about 16 at the time and he was living in Alaska, he was killed during a bow hunting trip.
Wow.
Yeah, they were living in Anchorage and he was right near the Fort Richardson Army Base. And Brent had apparently gotten permission to hunt on that land. Well, as he's out there hunting, he was shot. And
oh my God.
Well, hold on. Like, I don't know that it was ever technically classified as a homicide. They still never figured out who fired those shots. And I say shots because according to his mom, Mary, he was found with 17 .22 caliber shells in his back. Wow. 17.
17? That's not an accident.
That's what I mean. So, and no one's ever been held accountable. I found an article where Joan Brooks, who was the Alaska State Registrar of Vital Statistics at the time, she said Brent Stavik died of multiple gunshot wounds to the head and chest by an unknown assailant or assailants.
Man, crazy.
I know. So we have that Brent's tragedy. And then in 1988, Mandy's stepbrother Spencer died in a boating accident on the Kenai River. He drowned. So like this family has been through its fair share of tragedy, and obviously, we're talking about the case today, so you know it's going to get worse.
And this is crazy because we're not just talking about the tragedies in the form of like people had a heart attack and then someone else had this or like cancer, some debilitating disease. I mean, these were bizarre deaths.
Yeah. For Mandy's mom to lose two kids. Oof.
Yeah. Awful.
Yeah. Well, before we get into what happens, I want to tell you a little bit more about Mandy. And I know that, like, everyone becomes a saint once they die. They lit up a room, or they were the life of the party, blah, blah, blah. But in this case, it's all true. Mandy was an extraordinary young woman. Like, not only was she beautiful, she had blonde curls and big, sparkling brown eyes. She truly had the most beautiful smile with these perfectly white, aligned teeth. She was incredibly bright and excelled in school. In high school, she was actually an honor student. On top of getting excellent grades, she was super active. She was a cheerleader. She played softball. She played basketball. She ran track. She rode horses. She played saxophone in the school band. And she even worked at the local YMCA, like in their child care section.
That's more skill. I don't have that many skills combined. Like, that's insane. And it sounded like she was so well-rounded. Like, you don't often hear of athletes that are also in band, too. So it's super cool. And she sounds really diverse. Like, she had a very wide group of friend, like a lot of different friend groups.
Oh, and she was a student body treasurer at her high school.
Oh, that too. Jeez,
just
man.
That too.
Good for her.
So this girl was a superstar, and her family said she always wanted to be the best, and she really was. Mandy was known around town for her upbeat and positive attitude. She was really good about setting goals for herself and going after them, and generally, she nailed them. Growing up, she actually wanted to be a pilot. That would change, though. And in the fall of 1989, she enrolled at Central Washington University, which is located in Ellensburg, Washington. And it's a little over 3 hours northwest of Acme. So on the map, it's like super close to the Canadian border. So I believe she was majoring in some sort of nutrition program. But since I know nothing about that, because the only fruit I eat are Jolly Rancher gummies.
You're the only person I know whose like nutritional pyramid is literally upside down. Like how you're alive is a medical miracle that should be studied. Seriously.
I feel like I live off others' miserability.
Not a word.
I made it up. But the point is that Mandy had no fear. And in the 2020 episode, her mom talked about how she told Mandy, you can't do track and another sport and this, that, like you can't do all this at once. And Mandy looked at her mom and said, you want to bet? And her mom ends that story with, never bet with Mandy.
Oof.
And just to highlight her mother, who's a badass, she's so strong in these interviews. Like, to go through everything she's been through, losing two children, I can't imagine. And on one of the shows, there's a guy who I think was a sheriff in the early 2000s. And he talks about the first time he met Mary. She was outside chopping wood with an axe. And she's like swinging this axe hardcore, splitting these logs like they're no big deal. And she was in her 70s.
Do they have a name? Like, they're not Lumberjack. Is there like a Lumberjill? Like, I feel like that's what she is. Yeah.
She is definitely a Lumberjill. So she's not only internally strong, but like physically strong as well.
Cool.
So in November of 1989, Mandy is in her freshman year of college, and she had been rooming with a Japanese exchange student named Yoko. And at this point in our story, it's Thanksgiving break. So Mandy goes home for the holidays, and she brought Yoko to enjoy Thanksgiving with her and her family. The girls had come home on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving, and they had gotten a ride with Mandy's ex, on-again, off-again kind of boyfriend, a guy named Rick Zender. Rick also went to the university. He was a year ahead of Mandy, though.
Okay.
And he and Mandy had dated in high school. And like I said, they were kind of on and off at this point. Rick is adorable. He's in this 2020 episode. And he's like, for some reason, she loved me. I thought she was so out of my league.
Brenda says that about me all the time. I get it. It's
okay. Let's be real. She's way out of your league.
It's true.
Jesus, it's a league you shouldn't even be allowed near, but okay.
Yeah.
So Rick dropped Mandy and Yoko off at Mandy's home in Acme around 2 p.m. on that Wednesday. And then that afternoon evening, Mandy introduced Yoko to like all of her high school friends and kind of showed her around town. And they actually stopped by the high school to drop in on the girls' basketball practice. Mandy was really close with the coach. I saw some articles about how he kind of became like a father figure. Since, you know, her dad was all the way up in Alaska.
Sure.
He actually does the eulogy at her funeral. So, you know.
Oh, wow, very nice.
Yeah, that they were close. So the next day is Thursday, November 23rd, 1989. The family has a wonderful day. Great Thanksgiving. Lots of food. Lots of family. Lots of love. So the next day is Friday, November 24th, Black Friday, my favorite holiday. And Mandy and Yoko had plans to go to the movies with some of Mandy's high school friends, like later, early evening. So that morning, the girls had taken a walk to the South Fork of the Noosac River, which was a little over 2 miles away from Mandy's home. And then around 2 p.m., Mandy decided to go for a run, because we already said she's super active, she loves to exercise, and she loved to run, and she had a specific route that she normally took. And I'm pretty sure it was the same route she had walked with Yoko earlier in the day. And I pulled it up on Google Maps, and I have a map we can put up on screen.
Okay, cool.
But it looks like it was a pretty straight route from Strand Road, where she lived, over Highway 9, and then to the river. So Mandy knows this route very well. And in records, there's a bit of confusion as to which direction she went. They aren't positive she stuck with her traditional route, but because like a few people claim to have seen her in the opposite direction of her normal route.
Okay.
And just for reference, her normal route was about 5 miles round trip. Could you imagine running that? I would be dead. Jesus.
My uncle was a track coach at my high school. He still does it. He's in his 70s and he still gets up every day. I'm like, how, dude? I have trouble driving 5 miles without being like, man, I'm stiff in the car.
I have flashbacks to the mile run and I'm starting to get sweaty thinking about it. Need my inhaler.
You see, girls could always like fake their period. I remembered like 10 girls couldn't run the mile that day. It's like,
and we never were allowed to get away with that.
I'm mouth breathing through them on lap two.
I just sucked on my inhaler the whole time and hoped for death at that point. Back to Mandy. Either way, regardless of what direction she went, she knew this town. She knew these roads. She knew everyone in town. She felt safe. Everybody in that town felt safe. At 1:55 p.m., Mandy and the family dog, this beautiful German shepherd named Kyra, they took off on a run. I read that Mandy's mom, Mary, would often accompany her on runs, and like Mary would ride her bike, and then Mandy and Kyra would run alongside her, which just adds like so much sadness to an already tragic situation. Like, Mary's in the 2020 episode talking about this. And she is still, all these years later, like, so upset with herself for not going going with Mandy.
Survivor's guilt is a real thing. Even when it doesn't involve murder, it's easy to put the blame on yourself with all the like shoulda, coulda, wouldas. So, I mean, I get it where she's coming
100% from. Survivor's guilt is horrific. I mean, just look at the girls from Idaho, the two girls who lived.
Yes.
Their testimony or their statements were chilling.
They're going to need to heal for a long, long, long time, if ever.
Oh, I just got goosebumps. Anyway, a delivery man remembered seeing Mandy at some point during her run, and actually, Mandy's little brother Lee saw her as well. He was over at a friend's house, a boy named Jeremy Anderson, and he saw his sister and Kyra running past, and she was going in the direction of their home. Like, she was super close, because I think Lee's friend's house was only, like, a couple doors down.
Oh, wow.
But okay. Again, the houses are, like, spread apart, so it's not, like, right next door, but it was close.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually think that Lee was the last person to see Mandy alive other than her killer.
Okay.
So a little while later, Lee came home, and when he got home and like he realized Mandy wasn't there, and he's like, that's really weird. Like, I just saw her. She was just on her way here. She should have beat me home. So by 4 p.m., Mary was getting incredibly concerned, and she began calling some of Mandy's friends and like asking neighbors if they had seen her. Nobody had. Then, and this would be haunting, Kira, the German Shepherd, returns home alone. No, Mandy. No. And this poor dog is clearly in distress. In court records, they talk about how her tail was tucked, she was cowering, and she was dirty. She had like dirt and silt, like river silt all over her.
Oh my God. It's a bad sign.
Yeah. And actually, later, they would try to get Kyra to, like, take them to where whatever happened.
Sure.
She wouldn't even leave the family porch. Like, this dog was so traumatized.
Dog intuition. It's real. They know things.
They're magic, and I love them. So, during all of this, the two friends, remember, Mandy and Yoko were supposed to go to the movies that night with two friends. So, during this time, those guys had showed up to, like, pick them up, but they ended up joining the search. So it was a kid named Brad Gorham and a kid named Tom Bass.
Okay.
So they had showed up. They're helping search. And then actually Rick Zender, Mandy's ex-boyfriend who had driven her home from college, he was also part of the searches. So by now it's 5:30 p.m. She left at 2. She should have been back by 3 at the latest. So Mary calls the police and, you know, major searches begin shortly after. Neighbors and friends joined the searches, as did the Whatcom County Search and Rescue Team. They even brought in a human tracker, and he was able to look at the area, and he discovered an area on the shoulder of the road right near Mandy's house that looked, quote, disturbed. And court records say there were several footprints, most likely made by two people, and I guess the way the ground looked, the tracker believed that a struggle had taken place there. And he also realized that close by, like right off the road, was a ditch. And that ditch was filled with the same kind of dirt and silt that poor Kyra had like been covered on her sweet little pupper body. So by Saturday afternoon, Mandy's disappearance was no longer considered just a missing person, but upgraded to a presumed abduction. Searchers were looking everywhere, and it wasn't just ground searches. They had people on foot, on bikes, on horseback. They had helicopters, they had boats, they had airplanes. They brought in search dogs, and at one point they did find a pair of green sweatpants in the surrounding woods, and Mandy had been wearing green sweatpants, but when they showed them to her mom, she's like, I don't recognize them, I don't think they're hers. And then they also had a search dog like sniff them, and the dog couldn't get Mandy's scent off from the sweatpants.
So they weren't hers, Ben. Yeah.
Yeah, it was eventually determined that they had nothing to do with Mandy. So everyone in this town is searching, and this part is really, really sweet. A couple people in town started like a fundraiser, like the OG GoFundMe going door to door.
Yeah.
And they collected money for a reward fund. In 24 hours, they had collected almost $10,000.
Wow. So people cared about her.
Oh my God. And I read somewhere that most people donated between like $10 and $50. This wasn't like a super wealthy community, but they gave what they could. So to get to $10,000 from donations of 10, 20, 30, clearly a ton of people had donated.
Yeah.
So there were so many comments and quotes about how, like, the whole town felt like it was their daughter that had gone missing. This community really showed up for Mandy and Mary and the rest of the Stavik family.
We're talking about a murder case. I'm guessing it ultimately didn't matter, but I always like hearing that when these communities rally for one of their own.
Agreed. But yes, you're right, because on the morning of Monday, November 27th, 1989, all hopes of Mandy coming home safely were dashed. Detective Ron Peterson was the one who spotted Mandy first. In the 48 Hours episode, he talks about how he was in a little boat and, like, they had split off from the main river into this little channel, and suddenly he saw something pink. And as they got closer, Detective Peterson realized that they had found a body floating face down. In order to preserve evidence, he actually physically got into the water, and it was only about knee high, so he was able to get in the water and turn her over. And he knew right away who it was. She was completely nude except for her socks and running shoes. And Detective Peterson said that when he was pulling her body out of the water, he's like, I didn't see her. I saw my own daughter, who was the same age as Mandy. And the two of them had been friends. They went to school together.
Man, that's so hard. And I know everybody likes to shit on cops these days, but they're human beings too, you know, and things like this affect them just like it would you and me.
It's funny you say that, because something that really struck me about this case in particular, how much Mandy's murder impacted the people in town. Like, on some of the shows I was watching, they have a ton of different law enforcement guys on, and I'm sure they've all seen some serious shit in their day, but my God, these grown men, these beefy ass detectives and everything else, they are talking about this case, they're talking about Mandy, and just breaking down into tears. And remember, these shows are filmed 25 to 30 years later after the murder happened. So you can tell how, like, it still affects the town. And it was just heartbreaking to everyone, because it was really clear that Mandy had been an incredibly special young woman.
If you had this happen to one of your loved ones, those are the detectives you want working the case, because right there it shows you how much they care, because a lot of them do have families. If they don't have daughters, they have nieces, they have sisters, and they can kind of put things into perspective in as it relates to their own life.
100%. And there was actually one interview where they were talking to an officer, and he starts talking about it, and all of a sudden he stops and he's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And he just, like, breaks down. Like, it was clear he was shocked that he broke down, but he was just talking about it and he couldn't handle it. I mean, I get it.
Can I tell you what's messed up too? Like, from a producer standpoint, that's like gold, and it's so crappy because you're trying to ask questions that elicit these kind of emotions. But when those emotions happen, we shut up. Like, I don't ask another question for 15, 20 seconds. You want people to see them live in that moment, because that silence is more powerful than anything they could say next.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I want to talk about the injuries that Mandy sustained, but we'll get to that in a minute. Just a little bit more about where she was found. She was found upstream, a few miles from her home, and, like, a few miles from where she had last confirmed to have been seen. And her body was caught up in some kind of debris that was on the edge of the water, like a branch had kind of blocked her so she couldn't float any further. Investigators were never able to determine where she went into the water. Like, they never had a specific crime scene to be able to investigate.
So that last series I worked on, I learned a lot about this stuff, and specifically that part of the country, perpetrators will toss people into the water, assuming that they're going to drift far away. And because a lot of these tributaries lead to larger bodies of water and sometimes even the Pacific Ocean. So the idea is that I'm going to drop them in here. They're going to float by the time anyone realizes that she's going to turn up in some giant body of water and no one will even tie her to the area. But they don't anticipate, like, Mother Nature doesn't mess around. They can often get hung up on sticks. Their gases build up in their body, which causes them to float differently. Sometimes they sink. Sometimes they hit a rock.
Right. So the medical examiner, a guy named Dr. Gary Goldfogel, he performed the autopsy later that day, like Monday night sometime. And the water temperature had actually preserved her body very well. So, I mean, that was a plus. But because of that, like, one of the police officers said, he's like, she just looked like she was sleeping, which I imagine is really, really hard to see as well.
Yeah.
The cause of death was freshwater drowning or asphyxiation by drowning. Semen was found inside Mandy, so we know that she had been sexually assaulted. She had sustained blunt force injury on the right side of her forehead. She had a hematoma, which is bleeding under the skin, pretty much. And that was about 2 inch by 3 inches, like on the top of her head / her forehead. And her body, specifically the front of her body and the sides of her arms and legs, she was covered in all these cuts and scrapes, which ended up leading the medical examiner and the police to believe that she had tried to run from her attacker, and she would have had to run through blackberry bushes, which have thorns. So from reading the court records and the notes from the medical examiner, the main theory was that someone in a vehicle managed to grab Mandy, and when Kyra, the dog, tried to intervene, she was kicked into a ditch.
That's why she was covered in all that dirt and stuff.
Exactly. And then Mandy was taken to another location where she was raped. And then they think she must have tried to run away through those blackberry bushes with the thorns, but the assailant caught up to her. Then he hit her with something that likely rendered her unconscious. And then she was put into the water where she drowned. And Mandy had been a lifeguard, and this water was very shallow, like knee deep. And she was an incredibly strong swimmer, so it didn't make sense that she would drown unless she was unconscious.
She must have been so scared.
And we're going to later find out she knew who this horrible person was, which just has to make it 100 times worse.
Yeah, like how could you?
So Dr. Goldfogel analyzed Mandy's stomach contents, and he was able to determine she was killed shortly after she had been abducted, like sometime on that Friday afternoon between 3:30 and 4:30 p.m. And she was just so close to home, like she and Kyra were almost there.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, I hate that. I mean, I always hate it, but I hate it even more when it's like they could see their house from where they were.
Yeah,
like,
oh, you're so close to being out of it.
Yes. The medical examiner was able to get samples of the semen found inside Mandy, which were preserved and sent to the FBI and Washington State Crime Lab. But at this point, we're in 1989, so DNA evidence is pretty new.
Yeah.
Not many people knew too much about it. And according to that 2020 episode I watched, the FBI was really the only law enforcement agency that had both the scientists who were trained in DNA and also the equipment that could handle the DNA.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
What really helped this case, and I think they got super lucky, was that our wonderful detective Ron Peterson, he had just recently been to Quantico to some sort of training course all about DNA. So when they found Mandy, he was on top of it. He was so adamant about swabbing for DNA, making sure it was preserved correctly, so on and so forth. And once it was sent to the lab, they were able to create a DNA profile for both Mandy and an unknown male, which is great, except they didn't have anyone to compare it to.
Yeah, and this is before databases and stuff, so it's
you
have limited things you can do with that.
Absolutely. I mean, CODIS and everything else is years away.
Yeah, you could blood type, I think, but that was about the extent of it. Or if you had someone to make a direct match to, I think that was in play.
Yeah, but they didn't have anyone. So, right. And with that, the case pretty much went cold, like pretty quickly. Mm. And I want to make it clear, it was not for lack of trying. From my research, I truly believe this law enforcement agency put everything they had into this case for years and years after Mandy was killed. And it was kind of interesting because this is a small town. So a lot of people grew up together. They end up staying. They get a job in that town. They stay in that town. They have families in that town, etc. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like every officer who worked in that department had at one point worked on this case, or maybe they were young when it happened, but they had always been told this story, and then they grew up and started working on it, which I thought was, I don't want to say cool. I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but
it's one of those legacy cases. Like, it's just that they live in those detectives' minds forever, and it's a case they will never forget.
Absolutely. And that is, it's funny you said that, because I think the 48 Hours episode is literally called Mandy Savick, the case that no one could forget.
Well, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
These small towns, you know, it's they become the face of that town, but not for a good reason.
Right.
It just is course. What it is.
So once Mandy's body was found, pretty much the first person they spoke to was Rick, her on again, off again boyfriend. And they had been like on again, off again for about 3 years. And you always have to look at the people closest to the victim first.
Well, especially if there's semen found. I mean, you got to rule out any sexual partners.
Yeah, of course. But they questioned him and he was ruled out almost immediately. And Mandy's family knew that Rick could never have hurt her. And like I mentioned, Rick is on the 2020 episode and he clearly loved Mandy so much. Like he even says like about your first love leaving a mark. And that was evident. He just breaks down crying a few times. And again, this is 25, 30 years later, but he's absolutely adorable. And I hope he's doing well.
Yeah, you can only hope.
Yeah. So police, even though the case does go cold, they were getting hundreds of tips per day and they were following up on all of them. They actually brought in an FBI profiler at one point who, part of the profile they came up with, it was said that the person was most likely someone in the community, which is horrifying.
That's the first thing I thought of because of the having, again, been out there, you know how these towns are laid out. It either has to be someone that knows the lay of the land or the other thing I thought was a serial killer because they just kind of run rampant throughout that region.
Yeah, Washington, looking at you. That's where we are. When I read, I knew about this case, but I couldn't remember where it was. And I saw one. I was like, well, of
course.
You're
like, well, serial killer.
Oh, guys, what are you doing out there? I tell my brother all the time, when you get murdered out there, don't come crying to me.
You know what happens out there.
Exactly. Sorry, Matthew. So investigators would occasionally have a person of interest, but every single time they were ruled out. And a lot of these people were ruled out after submitting their DNA. So it's not like, oh, they passed a polygraph, they're fine. Like, they legitimately were ruled out.
Actually ruled out, yeah.
At one point, investigators actually had to consider that Mandy's murder was the work of the infamous Green River Killer, a.k.a. Gary Ridgway.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, he operated like in and around Seattle from 1982 all the way to 1998, and he wasn't caught until 2001. So Mandy could have very well been one of his victims, although she didn't exactly fit his victim profile.
Yeah, it sounds like based on how you're describing her, she was around the same age, like body type, but he generally murdered sex workers or runaways that he would like lure. So
into his,
not quite, yeah.
But still, you know, if he were driving past and see a young girl, you know, with whatever's wrong in the head, that head of his.
Yeah.
Ugh. Eventually, they were able to rule out it wasn't the Green River Killer. And that was kind of that. The days would become months, months became years, and eventually those years of not knowing what happened became decades of not knowing what happened. And I kind of mentioned this earlier, but over the years, these new officers would come on the force and new sheriffs would take over, and each one was handed Mandy's case file, which by the early 2000s was about 4,000 pages.
Wow.
Can you imagine getting that handed to you?
It's massive. Here's a box. Good luck.
And, you know, each person would analyze it. They'd go through it from cover to cover. And there was just always that hope that a pair of fresh eyes would find something. But that hope began to dwindle. And Mandy's family and really the whole town of Acme, they started to kind of come to terms with the idea that this case might never be solved. We're going to fast forward because, again, not much happened. So in 2009, so literally 20 years after this happened, Detective Kevin Bowie took over the case, and seeing that his predecessors had done pretty much all that they could do at the time, he made the decision to do a DNA sweep. So they pulled up records from 1989, and they looked at where people lived and how old they would have been at the time of the murder, and these officers started going door to door requesting DNA samples. They eventually had collected 80 samples.
Wow.
None were a match.
You figure in a town like that size, every male is a suspect.
Absolutely. Anyone between the age of whatever ages in 1989, you have to count them.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're going to fast forward again to the summer of 2013. So this is 24-ish years after Mandy's murder. It's a hot day in June when two mothers are sitting at a public pool watching their kids play. And these women, they didn't know each other before that day. They were just kind of like, happened to be sitting in the same lounge chairs, and their kids started playing. So the women, Mary Lee Anderson and Heather Backstrom, they struck up a conversation and they quickly realized, like, they knew a lot of the same people. Small town, of course they know the same people. And at one point, Mandy's name gets brought up because, again, this was like town, I don't want to say town legend, but like everyone knew about it.
Well, yeah.
And suddenly Heather says, I know who killed her. Oh. And Mary Lee was shocked, but then she kind of thought about it and she responded, I do too. Tim Bass.
Yo, cue the crow. Wasn't that a friend of Wendy's?
Look at you kind of paying attention. You're close. Mandy was friends with Tim's younger brother, Tom. They were classmates and friends. And Tom was one of the boys, along with Brad Gorham and Rick, who like had come over to the house after she went missing because they had were supposed to have gone to the movies. So Tom Bass is the friend, and Tim Bass is the guy that the water park ladies said they believe killed Mandy.
Okay.
Now, why would they say that? Well, they have their reasons. So Heather and Mary Lee start swapping stories about their run-ins with the monstrous Tim Bass. Mary Lee goes first, and this incident occurred a few years after Mandy had been killed. So one night, she's home alone with her infant baby, and she hears a knock at the door, and it's Tim Bass. And Mary Lee's husband, I believe he was out of town at this time, or he just, at least he wasn't home. But he was friends with Tim. They had gone to high school together. So Mary Lee didn't know Tim well, but like she knew him as a friend of her husband's, like kind of as an acquaintance. So she opens the door, sees it's Tim, and he explains that he had been out hunting and he needed to use her phone. And as this was a friend of her husband, Mary Lee was like, okay, sure, you know, come on in. So she allowed him to come in the home and she directed him towards the phone. So he takes the phone and pretends to be using it, but Mary Lee is like right in the next room. She can hear the beep, beep, beep. Like, do you remember on landlines? Yeah, it's like on landlines, if the phone was off the hook for too long, it would start beeping. So you heard it to put it back on the hook.
It was your reminder. Yeah, it's like, oh crap, phone's off the hook. And sometimes it would even be seated wrong. Like you'd hang it up, but it wouldn't even be on the thing right, and it would start beeping.
Yes. So she hears this beep and she's like, oh my God, he's not using the phone. Like, wow. He lied about that.
Creepy.
So she's immediately uncomfortable. So Tim hangs up the phone and he begins telling Mary Lee that he had always had a thing for her. She was so beautiful. He was in love with her and he wanted to make love to her.
Gross.
So gross. So Mary Lee is like, hell no, get the hell out of my house. And remember, she's home alone with like her infant baby.
Yeah.
And now this predator is trying to convince her to go back to her bedroom to sleep with him.
So skeevy.
She keeps telling him no, telling him to get out, but he just kept like pushing her and trying to lead her back to her bedroom. And she was just like, absolutely not. And in an article by Alan Sorkin for CBS, she was quoted as saying, finally, I told him I would call the police, and somehow, I don't even remember exactly how, I got him out of my house, end quote.
So he was a predator.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. And I mean, this was like a clear, calculated plan. Like, I doubt he was even hunting. He probably just drove over to her house to try to get him to sleep with her, try to get her to sleep with him.
Put a camo jacket on, throw your bow in your car, and just use that as your...
Right. Oh, I was totally hunting. And I think the part about the phone is so creepy. And when I read that about, and I could hear the beep, beep, beep in my head, and I got like such a chill down my spine.
You can see it in a crime show. You could probably see it, the phone dangling by a cord close up with the beep, beep, beep. Oh, it's terrifying.
So thank God she was able to get him out. But this incident stayed with her for years. And she had always believed in her gut that Tim had killed Mandy. But again, gut feelings are not admissible.
They are not.
So now it's Heather's turn to talk about her run-in with Tim Bass. And this actually happened a few months before Mandy's murder. So at this point, Bass is like 21 to 22 years old, and Heather was only 15. And she had been at the softball game with this guy named Dan. Side note, Dan and Heather would later get married. At this point in our story, though, they're just friends.
Okay.
So the softball game ends, and Dan and Heather start heading to Dan's truck. They were planning on heading to the Dairy Queen. What else do you do in a small town?
It's true.
So Tim hitches a ride with them, which, first of all, I'm like, why is this 21-year-old hanging out with high schoolers?
Because he's a loser.
Exactly. Clearly. That's the only answer. So the three of them get into Dan's truck, and it was like a bench seat. So Dan was driving, Heather's in the middle, and Bass is next to her. And he kind of is like leaning up against her, and Heather's feeling uneasy. You know, it just seems like he's sitting incredibly close to her, although it is a small truck. So that's hard to be like, move over, you know?
Yeah.
He's like trying to talk to her, and then he takes a pen from Dan's cup holder, and he starts like running this pen up and down Heather's leg and like around her knee. And while this is happening, he's also telling her how beautiful she was and how she had beautiful eyes. And Heather is very obviously uncomfortable.
Bro, she's 15.
Exactly. This grown-ass man is aggressively like trying to flirt with her. And luckily, she was like really glad that Dan was there, you know, because nothing was going to happen if he was there. But she basically had to ignore him until he stopped. And
but also, he's doing that in front of another person. Like,
I know. Like, what are you doing?
What?
Well, from that day on, Heather would go out of her way to avoid Tim any way she could, obviously.
Clearly.
And then, just like Mary Lee, Heather had always felt like deep down, Tim was a truly evil predator. Both women had always thought that if Tim acted that way around them, he had most certainly acted that way around other women.
Yeah.
So was Mandy one of them? So the women together decide to talk to police. You know, there's strength in numbers. And I think by hearing similar situations, both women were like validated in like that feel like my feeling about this guy and that he's a monster is legitimate.
Sure.
Like I'm right here.
Yeah.
And I understand why they didn't go to the police years earlier. They didn't have any true evidence. In that CBS article I referenced earlier, Mary Lee says, quote, "I really wasn't ready because we're in a small town, and to accuse someone of something we don't know for sure is a little scary." End quote. A lot of scary.
Yeah.
So they actually ended up calling a friend of theirs who they went to high school with, who was a police officer on the Acme force.
Before we move on, I just wanted the irony. It's so hard for me to trust the Acme police force because it's very Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote. Like,
I agree.
Everything was Acme. It's like, oh man, the Acme PD.
And to be fair, I don't think it was Acme PD. I think it was Whatcom County Sheriff.
Oh, good. Okay.
Don't worry. So investigators start doing a little bit of digging into Tim Bass. And just an FYI, neither Tim nor Tom nor their father, Bud, had ever been looked at. And none of their DNA had ever been asked for or taken.
Especially Tom, because he and Mandy were friends. That's surprising.
Right. Like, he was one of the first people on the scene. And They only lived a couple doors down. I don't know. God. Like, maybe it's because he was at her house when police originally arrived to take the missing persons report.
Maybe.
Like, maybe time frame. They didn't think it could have happened.
Yeah. Hmm.
Anyway, they're looking into Tim's background. He had graduated from the same high school as Mandy. He had graduated in 1986, so 3 years prior to Mandy graduating. And the Bass family was made up of mom, dad, Tim, and then younger brother Tom. And they lived on the same street as Mandy, just a few houses down. So obviously the Bass family knew the Stavik family. Tom and Mandy had been friends. They were hanging out that day. The kids at her house.
Jeez.
So police have this information and they discover that Tim had left Acme shortly after Mandy's murder, like within a few weeks.
Red flag.
And he had moved away in January. It was January of 1990. So, like, we're barely 2 months later.
Yeah, 2 months or something, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he also got married not long after that to a girl still in high school. The girl was, like, 17, 18, while he's, like, 21, 22. And in the grand scheme of things, that is no big deal, that age difference.
But at those ages,
oh, it's my God. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
So his eventual wife's name, her name is Gina Malone, and they met while she was working at her grandfather's shop. I think it was like a general store of some sort. So Gina and Tim start dating, and he very quickly proposed marriage. And Gina's on the 2020, and she says they were going to wait to get married until she graduated high school. But then the marriage happened very suddenly. So I'm honestly not sure if she had graduated at that point or not. But either way, they were married sometime in spring or summer of 1990, and then Tim and Gina would go on to have 3 children. So years later, when police speak to Gina about her now ex-husband. They do divorce in 2019. They find out some pretty interesting information. In a surprise to no one, Tim was jealous, he was cruel, he was a master manipulator, and the ultimate gaslighter.
Really? Never saw that coming.
I know, shocking. He had the final say over what Gina wore, where she went, who she hung out with. And in the 2020 episode, she talks about how he wouldn't even call her by her first name. Instead, he referred to her as woman, bitch, or whore.
Oh, very endearing.
So he's a charmer.
Yeah.
And she would be like, please don't call me those names. And he would tell her to lighten up and learn to take a joke. Oh, and apparently he also loved watching crime shows and telling Gina how these people are so stupid. If he committed a murder, he would never get caught.
Dude, okay, if you watch these crime shows, you know everybody gets caught.
Exactly. Like, you're not going to not get caught. So sometime in 2010, Gina had actually filed for a domestic abuse protection order. And it wasn't just for her. It was also for their three children. Unfortunately, though, she did later rescind this protection order and it was dropped. So now back to 2013, the two water park mothers had gone to police with their suspicions, and Detective Bowie and his team had looked into Tim's background, and they're like, I think we should ask for his DNA. So they get to his house, and this dumbass pretended to have no idea who Mandy was. Never heard of her. Mandy who? And Detective Bowie is like, really? He knew this was a lie right away because everyone in that town knew about Mandy. Stop it. So after his piss poor acting performance, he's finally like, oh, is that the girl who went missing? The one in the river?
Yeah.
And police are like, uh-huh. So they ask for his DNA and Tim refuses. He says he didn't trust the police, that they were going to frame him, and he told them no warrant, no DNA.
So obviously everyone has the right to decline that, but that more often than not makes you look more guilty, and chances are they're just going to come back with a warrant, like assuming they have enough evidence to get one. So
exactly.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, unfortunately, though, that's kind of what happened here. Like, law enforcement didn't have enough cause to get a warrant for Tim's DNA, so Mandy's case would remain idle for the next year and a half. So it's like each time they get a little bit, they get stopped.
Yeah. And this is a prime example of why these cases remain cold for decades, because sometimes we only see the major headlines, but behind the scenes, these are the roadblocks that detectives are hitting.
Just roadblock after roadblock. So at this point, we're in February of 2015, and police decide to have another chat with Timmy. And this interaction rattles Tim, and he begins getting a little nervous. So Tim tells his brother Tom that he's worried police are going to frame him for Mandy's murder because actually he and Mandy had had sex before she died.
That's a great defense, to be
honest. And Tom's like, wait, what? Like, when? How? What? Tom was skeptical for a few reasons. First of all, he knew that Mandy had only been home since Wednesday afternoon. And then she died Friday afternoon, and Thanksgiving was in the middle. So when could this sexual escapade, like, when could it even have happened?
Yeah.
And then he's also like, and how in the world did you get Mandy to sleep with you, basically?
Well, there's that, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And Tim's response is documented in court records. You just want to punch him. He said, quote, oh, I just went up to her and said, oh, you're keeping fit. And that was it. End quote.
All right, gross. So I obviously don't know Tim, I don't know Mandy, but I find it hard to believe that this dollar store Casanova was like so charming that he was like, you look fit. And Mandy was like, ooh, hubba hubba.
Could you? Oh.
It's lame.
And that's almost like a backhanded compliment. Like, I don't know. I just feel like it's kind of like,
it's an egomaniacal thing. I mean, he's a narcissist.
Ugh. So Tim would go on to say that actually he and Mandy had hooked up a few times shortly before she left for college. And if that wasn't enough nonsense already, Tim told Tom, you should tell the police that you hooked up with and slept with Mandy too. Because Tim wanted to portray Mandy as just some chick who slept around with anyone who looked her way. Yeah. And Tom was like, I'm not going to do that. You might think that Tim is at rock bottom for being the sleaziest creep ever for asking his brother to do that.
I do.
You haven't heard the worst of it. Rock Bottom has a basement.
Oh.
And that's where Tim is.
Wow.
So this interaction is in the court records as well. After Tim had that conversation with Tom, he and Gina, because they're still married at the time, they go over to Tim and Tom's mom's house. Her name's Sandra. So this disgusting chunk of sun-roasted mayonnaise asks his mother if they could all agree to tell the police that his dead father, Sandra's dead husband, had been the one who raped and murdered Mandy. He wanted to pin the murder on his dead father.
This is as desperate and pathetic as it gets. And it's also super convenient to like blame someone who isn't even alive to defend themselves.
I told you, Rock Bottom has a basement and we're in the crawl space.
You were right.
Well, according to court records, Sandra reportedly put her face in her hands and told him no. Now, I wish I knew what else happened in this conversation, but I'm sure in that moment, Sandra had to have known that her son's a murderer.
Well, yeah.
And I will say that later Sandra's like, oh, that conversation never happened. But Gina was there, so.
Yeah, and that's such a tough predicament for a parent because your job as a parent is to protect your children. But at the same time, I feel like if one of my children did something this horrific, that it would be my duty to that victim's family as a fellow parent to go to police.
And you need to hold your child accountable.
That exactly.
They did something wrong. They need to be punished for it.
Yeah.
So in our timeline, we are somewhere in spring of 2015. And at the time, Tim was employed as a delivery driver for like Franz Bakery. I think this was more like an Entenmann's or like a Pepperidge Farm kind of bakery. So like not a fresh bakery, but one that made and sold like packaged baked goods. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I say that because police went to speak with the manager of the Franz Bakery outlet store. And that seems to be where the delivery trucks were kept at night and like when they weren't in use. So the police go to his manager. Her name is Kim Wagner. And Kim is another badass, but we'll get there. Investigators ask Kim if they could swab the delivery trucks in hopes of getting touch DNA. And they do not tell Kim why they needed the DNA, nor do they tell her whose DNA they were looking for. And Kim's like, oh, that's above my pay grade. Like, you kind of get permission from corporate.
Mm-hmm.
So she gave investigators the contact information. They call corporate. But when they ask for permission to swab the trucks, corporate's like, no, nope,
wow, you can't really? Do
it. Yeah. So yet again, Mandy's case is at a standstill. They couldn't get permission to swab the trucks, and they didn't have enough calls for a warrant.
Yeah, and that's frustrating for police, I know, but also I imagine for the community, too, for all these years to have passed and still no one's in custody.
Yeah, and I imagine for the two water park women, Mary Lee and Heather, they're probably like, what's going on? Like, we told you this how many years ago?
We literally told you his name.
Yeah. So now nothing happens for another 2 years. So now we're in May of 2017.
Wow.
Detective Bowie calls Kim Wagner, the manager at the bakery outlet, and he asks if she can give him the delivery route that Tim Bass took every day. And before Kim gives him any information, she asks, are you investigating Mandy's murder, Mandy Stavik? And Detective Bowie confirms that yes, this was in regard to the Stavik murder. So Kim then asks if this was an investigation into Tim Bass.
See, so she knows she's...
And again, Detective Bowie responds in the affirmative, and he's like, yep. Which I'm kind of like, well, if they asked for his route specifically, it would make sense that he's the subject of the investigation, but still.
No, we were just curious.
We just wanted to know. Have a good one.
We just wanted a day in the life of a delivery driver.
Yep. So after the detective says yes, he explains that they were basically trying to get his DNA on something that he may throw out along his route. And Kim asks, what do you think you could collect? And Detective Bowie's like, it could be a cup he drank off of. It could be a cigarette butt he discarded, a spoon he used, etc., etc. So Kim agrees to give them the details of Tim's route.
She knows small town secrets. She even is in on it.
Exactly. Yep. When I first heard that we were going to do small town secrets, this case pretty much immediately came to mind.
Yeah, this is it. This is what we're talking about.
Yeah. So now the next step is for police to tail Tim as he makes his deliveries. And they do. They surveil him for a few days. To their disappointment, Tim never throws anything out. Now, while this was like a conscious decision or just coincidence, we don't know. But so Kim had asked if Detective Bowie would keep her in the loop about everything. And he agrees and he tells her, well, we followed him, but we haven't been able to get anything. He's just not thrown anything out. So badass Kim is like, well, what if I got something he threw out with his DNA on it? And the detective's like, well, that would be fine. But
wink, wink. We're not saying.
He makes it very clear he is not asking her or encouraging her to do anything in regard to this investigation. So a few days later, Kim, I think she actually texted him and she's like, I did it. I got his DNA.
That's awesome. Good for her.
So they meet in the bakery parking lot and she provides the detectives with two items that Tim had handled and then discarded. A Coca-Cola can and a plastic drinking cup.
That's so, had to be so scary for her because like she's heard all the rumors and like she's taking a big risk of trying to pin it on this guy. But you just know, again, these gut feelings, you know.
Yes. So they package up the items and they're sent off to the Washington State Crime Lab. And what do you know? Tim's DNA is a perfect match to the semen found inside Mandy.
Crazy.
28 years after her murder, they had an answer as to who killed Mandy Stock.
Amazing.
Tim Bass. So in December of 2017, and I understand that's a long way from like May of 17, but I'm assuming by the time all this got rolling and they got the results back from the lab.
There's so much paperwork too, and stuff.
You
have to dot all your I's, cross your T's because you had, again, one shot at this.
Exactly. So at this point, it's December of 2017, and Tim Shitbag Bass was arrested and charged with Mandy's murder. And of course, Tim tells everyone that he's innocent and the cops were just out to get him. He actually, while he was in prison, his mom, Sandra, and Tom went to visit him. He begged them to give him an alibi. He wanted them to say he couldn't have hurt Mandy. We were all Christmas shopping.
That's not a bad alibi. I mean, it was Black Friday.
Exactly. But thankfully, Sandra and Tom did not oblige, and Tom would testify about this in court, actually. He also stated that Tim had once said, quote, Tom, do what you can. And then he tried to convince Tom to tell police that a whole bunch of guys knew Mandy, which I'm guessing means he was trying to get Tom to tell police that, like, anyone could have killed her because she got around.
Yeah, this was, he was desperate. He needed someone to provide something that threw police off of him, and he was panicking.
And thank goodness Tom was not trying to lie under oath for his stupid-ass rapist murderer brother. Thank God.
Yes.
I think the mom would have lied, but...
We'll never know.
So this is from the court records regarding what Tim was charged with. First degree felony murder. And then they added that the state is, quote, alleging that Bass had caused Stavik's death in the course or furtherance of attempted rape, kidnapping, or attempted kidnapping.
That's the compounding factor. So if it was just a murder, then it first degree is tough to, you know what I mean? So that sets it to that level.
It's kind of like the case we covered in December about the two sisters, and they were able to get him on felony one murder because he committed a robbery along with a rape and a murder.
Exactly, yeah. Of another crime.
So Tim's trial begins in May 2019, literally 30 years, 30 years.
Wild.
Like, you could have a whole human who goes through high school and college and gets a job and has their own
kids.
And
have a family,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. That's wild when you think about it. So this trial lasts about 3 weeks. And prior to the trial beginning, Tim's lawyers tried to argue that the DNA evidence that Kim got shouldn't be admissible. She shouldn't have been working as an agent of the police. Wah, wah, wah. But Kim testified. She's like, no one asked me to get the DNA. I did it on my own.
Right.
And the court ultimately agreed because they told Tim to sit down and shut the F up. Not those exact words, I don't think, but you get it.
Oh, so it wasn't the Honorable Melissa Spivey presiding?
I would be the best judge.
No, you would not.
I'd be like, I don't like your face. You're absolutely guilty.
Guilty. LWAP.
Yep, you're so guilty. Oh, and another thing they tried to say that it wasn't right that she gave Tim's delivery route to them, but everyone else is like, okay, they could sit outside and wait for his truck to leave.
Yeah.
Like, not really that big of a deal.
Grasping at straws.
Yep. And actually, Gina, his now ex-wife, because their divorce was finalized in March of 2019, so mm-hmm. 2 months prior to the trial, she testified against him.
Good. Good for her.
On May 24th, 2019, Timothy Forrest Bass was found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of Amanda Mandy Stavik.
Awesome.
And then the jury delivered what is called a special verdict. So Tim was found guilty of first-degree rape and kidnapping and also attempted first-degree rape and kidnapping. And I didn't know what a special verdict was, so I asked ChatGPT, and I still don't really get it. But ChatGPT, I literally told ChatGPT, explain it to me like I'm five.
It just gave you a flip book.
Yes, it should have. And this is what it spit out. Spoiler alert, I still don't really get it. Quote, a special verdict is when the jury answers specific questions about the facts of a case instead of just saying who wins, end quote. And then it gave an example saying that the jury finds the facts and the judge makes the final decision based on those facts. So I'm not sure I really get it, but if anyone knows what that means, please explain it to me like I'm three. Please write in. But regardless, on July 2nd, 2019, Tim was sentenced to the maximum 320 months in prison, which equals just shy of 27 years.
I don't think that's nearly enough.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, the good news is that he was 51 when he was sentenced.
Okay, so it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, so just EdGPT can kind of shed some light on the special verdict. So they're super rare, and you see them from time to time, usually when a case is super complex. And an example would be if there's a case where there's clear evidence that a defendant was negligent, but there's also evidence that a plaintiff, and I'm not talking about this case, but the plaintiff also had negligence. So in that instance, a jury would be tasked with answering questions to clarify, like, just how much negligence existed on each party's behalf. And then the judge would make the determination, not the jury.
Hmm. That doesn't really clear it up for me, but that's okay. Moral of the story, he got what was coming to him.
Yes, exactly.
And I thought this was kind of cool. Just a little side note. The prosecutor handled this case, David McEachran. He actually came out of retirement just to prosecute this case.
Oh, cool.
He had been the Whatcom County prosecutor from 1974 until he retired in 2018.
Oh, wow.
So he was the prosecutor when Mandy was killed. And like so many other people in the town, this case had stuck with him. This was the one he couldn't get out of his head.
Exactly. That's how much it meant to him to see this thing resolved.
And he came out of retirement just for that case. And in court, he said the following, quote, I've never seen a case that had an impact like this one did. People felt that they didn't have a sense of safety. It was the realization that we're not all that safe and that there was a monster who was really living among us, end quote.
Terrifying.
Right? So immediately, like same day he got like charged with everything, he filed an appeal. You know, whining about the evidence, like I said, with Kim, and whining about ineffective counsel and blah, blah, blah. But in 2021, the court was once again like, sit down and shut the F up. You're guilty. And as of today, Tim Bass is 57 years old and incarcerated at the Airway Heights Correctional Center in Airway Heights, Washington. And I realized that we've had so many Washington cases, and each time I look up their prison records, you can click for an alert if they get let out. So if he gets let out, I'll know about it.
You'll know
right
away.
Yes. But let's keep our fingers crossed that he will die courtesy of a slow and painful death in prison. And hopefully that shows the same amount of mercy that he showed Mandy.
Well, and what would that be? Because there's a chance he's going to get a few years. Like if he's 57 and he got, what, 27 years? So what is he? He's going to be in his mid-80s. I mean, he can still have a little bit of life, which, in my opinion, should not be.
No. Hopefully, though, he'll just die. Something awful. Flesh-eating disease.
Kidney disease from not drinking enough water.
Yeah, no water for you, douche. So That is the incredibly sad and frustrating case of Mandy Stavik. And yeah. It's also kind of fascinating. And by that, I mean, like, with every cold case, like, this case shows us that with every cold case, there is still hope.
Absolutely.
It might take 30 years, but there is still hope. And it sucks because Mandy never got to reach her full potential and achieve her ultimate goal of making the world a better place. But I think it's fair to say she has made such an impact on so many people.
That's going to be one of those towns where if you went into that area and said the name Mandy Stavik, everybody there would know, even if it's mm-hmm. the next generation, because these stories transcend, you know, you hear them. There's a case local to me here that I've heard about since I was young. And I had the privilege of actually covering it for a Deadly Affairs, the one with Susan Lucci. But mm-hmm. it was so neat because that for me, that was a big deal because this was town lore. And I actually got to clear up some of the rumors that I had been hearing by interviewing the actual prosecutor. So that was kind of neat. But yeah, this is one of those that is just going to be tied to that town forever.
Agreed. But I mean, hopefully Mandy is resting peacefully. And I hope her family's hanging in there, especially her mother, Mary. What a badass. And just so you know, Brent's murder is still technically unsolved, like her brother's murder. Wow. And I just want to end on a quote from Mandy's eulogy, which, as I said, was delivered by her high school basketball coach, Jim Freeman. He said, quote, "You see her smiling back at you, right at your soul, with eyes that say, I love life." End quote.
That's a neat story. And it does show, you're absolutely right, there is hope. And to any family that's going through something like this, don't give up. Don't let the police off the hook. Don't stop calling. Don't stop asking for answers. Keep yourself in the public eye. Keep your family member's case in the public eye because there is hope.
Yes, 100%.
Wow.
So that's all we got for you this week, but that is the first of a couple small town secret stories that we will share this month.
Yeah, how many? Are there four Tuesdays this month or five?
Yeah, there's four Tuesdays. So we'll have three cases and then the interview with Rob.
Yeah. So next week, I'm not even sure what next week is, but the week after that, I'll tell you all about David Wellington Reed and we'll share with you kind of that supplemental video that we made, which I need to cut together. But we got to really bring you guys to where this case happened so you can see just exactly what we're talking about. When we talk about the places, I feel like it's so helpful for me as a producer when I prep to go out on a shoot and read all about a town and think I understand it. But it's not until you get there that you really understand and you see the proximity that these different key locations are and you interact with the people and you get a sense for what really happened in these cases. So we're going to bring you something to kind of supplement, similar to what we did with Jason Sweeney.
Yeah. Yep.
Super cool.
All right. Well, if anyone has anything to say about this case or wants to explain to me like I'm three what a special verdict is, you can hit us up on our socials. Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Blue Sky at Murder Unscripted. Email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can visit our website at murderunscriptedpod.com.
I have a challenge for you next week.
For me?
Yeah, don't chuckle when you say Blue Sky.
I haven't been on it in weeks. I think I forget our password.
I still don't even. I've never been on it once.
I don't understand it. Anyway, until next week, be safe, stay hydrated.
Yes.
And remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But if they're running a pen over a 15-year-old's leg, that's a sign.
Exactly. They're a pervert, for sure. Oof, man. Gross.
See ya.
Bye.